Judge King, Judge Garza, Judge Higginbotham, may it please the court. Abandonment by the government of a theory of prosecution included in an indictment is an event which terminates jeopardy and bars a successive prosecution on that theory. In this case, the government, by its own actions, abandoned the only scheme to defraud charged by the grand jury. It was the sole basis for the charges in count one, a conspiracy to engage in mail and wire fraud, and in the substantive counts of mail and wire fraud charged in counts 3 to 9 of the first superseding indictment. The government first abandoned its honest services fraud theory. It abandoned that theory completely and forgave any indictment or prosecutorial theory under 18 U.S.C. section 1346. But far more importantly, the government, by its actions at trial, abandoned the theory indicted by the grand jury of the scheme or artifice to defraud. And that theory was that a money or property fraud had occurred when Mr. Haefner paid bribes and kickbacks to two employees of the Hartford Insurance Company in return for their false representation to their employer that the settlements with Mr. Haefner's clients were in the best interest of the Hartford. By the time the case went to the jury, Your Honors, the abandonment of these two theories of prosecution was complete, and there was nothing left to try Mr. Haefner on.
But the non-disclosure, and my difficulty with your argument is that there were still in the indictment the allegations that this money was paid and there was non-disclosure, this property was paid and there was a non-disclosure to the company, to Hartford. And that was not abandoned by the government, irrespective of kickbacks or bribes, that money was used, money that was intended to be paid to beneficiaries was in fact kept by these two individuals, and there was non-disclosure.
Judge Garza, that is the theory that the government has proffered to this court in its brief. Our position is quite simply, Judge Garza, that for double jeopardy purposes, the touchstone of this court's analysis must be the charges brought by the grand jury. And much as the court faces in other double jeopardy contexts, complex questions of determining what was barred, what was tried, and what was submitted to a jury. I don't intend to say that that task is any less complex here, but it is doable. The indictment here spoke with clarity. The grand jury proceeded on a single scheme to defraud. That scheme was, as I laid out a moment ago, that there had been a misrepresentation. The misrepresentation was that the settlements were in the best interest of the Hartford. And that misrepresentation was spawned by the payments of bribes and kickbacks. It was a quid pro quo for those bribes and kickbacks.
You're absolutely right, okay? But that same action, forget about the bribes. They were bribes. They were kickbacks. Forget about that. But the same action, the same factual scenario, supports the non-abandoned theory. That is to say that this money, however you want to characterize them, was diverted to these two individuals, and that fact, plus the fact that it wasn't used for their intended purpose, was not disclosed to the Hartford. Now, I understand. You know, we're talking two levels. We're talking the characterization level and we're talking the factual scenario level. You're characterizing this wonderfully well. Great. Let's abandon the bribes. Let's abandon the kickbacks. That does not abandon the fact that these monies were diverted and there was non-disclosure at a factual level, not at the characterization level, but at the factual level. And that's, I hope that explains.
Yes, Your Honor, that's quite helpful. And I agree with Your Honor that we need to look at the factual level. But the factual level, Your Honor, at what the grand jury charged. United States versus Russell teaches us that under the Fifth Amendment's grand jury clause, as well as the due process clause and the Sixth Amendment's fair notice clause, that we cannot proceed to trial on any theory not charged by the grand jury. So I think the grand jury here, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So you're suggesting that the indictment itself does not allege non-disclosure in this case? Non-disclosure of the misdirection of this property?
It's what non-disclosure did the indictment charge, Your Honor. First and foremost, in counts 3 through 9, the substantive counts, the grand jury alleged honest services fraud under 1346. 1346 was not alleged in the conspiracy in count 1. In counts 3 through 9, along with the 1346 charges, the grand jury used for the first time the word concealment. A reasonable interpretation of the grand jury's intent was that the honest services fraud included the concealment theory that the government now claims it can retry Mr. Haefner on. Now, there is some logic to that, Your Honor, that is not immediately apparent, and that is we need to put ourselves in the historic context here, that this case went to trial months after the Supreme Court granted certiorari in Black and Weyrich, before it granted certiorari in Skilling. The government, when it briefed all three of those cases in the Supreme Court, argued that there were two species of honest services fraud that survived vagueness challenge: bribes and kickbacks on the one hand, and a second theory, undisclosed self-dealing. The Supreme Court, in the discussion around footnote 45 in the Skilling decision, and with particularity in footnote 45, rejected that theory. Now, let's put ourselves back factually, as you suggest, Judge Garza. What really happened here? What happened here was the government proceeded on a theory of honest services fraud that was the concealment of the fact that the payments were made. It abandoned its honest services fraud, and with that, it abandoned that theory of prosecution. The second answer to your question, Judge Garza, is what was concealed? The government's apparent theory, as articulated in its brief, is that the concealment was independent of any exchanged for promise, any quid pro quo, any bribe or kickback.
Which is to say, they're different elements of these different offenses. Do you agree? That the elements for honest service is different and distinct from the elements that have to be proved for concealment?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that...
And if that's the case, can you have double jeopardy? If the elements are different?
Your Honor, double jeopardy applies to any theory that was found by the grand jury, presented to the Pettit jury, and abandoned by the government.
Or abandoned by the government,
all
right. That's right.
So here, the elements analysis, first of all, 1346 does not give us any new elements. It merely defines fraud in a different way. Fraud for purposes of this chapter shall include the right to honest services. It is not, 1346 is not a separate indictable offense. Elements of mail and wire fraud remain the same. Misrepresentation of a material fact with an intent to defraud. The misrepresentation here that would be either an active misrepresentation or a concealment was the misrepresentation of the fact that the payments were made. The BMW cars in counts 3 through 9 were transferred to the employees of the Hartford for their recommending that the settlements were in the best interest of the Hartford. What we now see is a theory that says that the government's newly coined theory is, forget if it was in return for anything, forget if it was corrupt in that sense, forget if it involved bribes or kickbacks. The mere fact of the payment itself is actionable fraud. That simply was not the theory that the grand jury indicted on. An analysis of the manner and means clauses of the grand jury's indictment demonstrates that the grand jury intended to charge the single scheme that I've now laid out twice, that any concealment, the well-knowing language in paragraph 18 that the government places so much emphasis on, was an integral part of the scheme itself. There was no separate scheme that, once the bribes for kickback scheme was abandoned, survived as an independent concealment scheme. Excuse me, Your Honor.
But you would agree that you could have two separate theories alleged on the same facts.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. And the Saylor and Kavanaugh cases out of the Sixth and Eighth Circuit referred to are paradigmatic examples of that.
And you can abandon theories without abandoning facts, the underlying facts. Can you not?
Your Honor, as a metaphysical matter, I guess I would agree that we
could. How about legal matter?
I think in the context of a contest of a courtroom, where facts are being presented to a jury as supportive of a legal theory, where there is an integration between the facts and the theory, as I would submit there always is.
If you have a negligence cause of action and a strict liability cause of action based on the same facts, and you waive the strict liability cause of action, are you telling me you can't go on the negligence cause of action?
No, Your Honor, but I would submit a different hypothetical. Let's assume that there's a murder prosecution and Defendant Doe is charged with murdering by use of a gun or a knife. The evidence at trial is that there was no knife, no knife wounds. Yeah. Government
that's
abandons.
A, that's, abandons a fact, its, that's a factual deficit that you're alleging, not a theoretical, I mean a theory problem.
But, Your Honor, I'm submitting there is no difference. In that hypothetical, the theory of prosecution is murder by gun or knife.
Yeah, okay. I think I understand your
And it's important to return it to the context of this case.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, Judge Higginbotham.
As you went to trial in this case, the government shifted gears on you in a pretty strong way. What exactly were you pitching to the jury at trial? Was it that these officials of Hartford had in fact extorted the money from the lawyer, and that it was not a bribe, or what was your defense?
Your Honor, that's close to it, but there was little more to it.
Well, I don't know what it is. That's what I'm asking.
The defense was, Your Honor, that first of all, the payments were in the best interest of the Hartford. The settlements themselves were settlements that the Hartford, in fact, continued with after they knew of the fraud. And because of that, since the settlements were in the best interest of the Hartford, it was extortion. That Rossall and Prestige had said, we'll make sure that these settlements don't go through unless there's a kickback to us.
Right.
That was the defense theory, Your Honor.
So they were indicting the witnesses.
Excuse me, Judge King? I think it is, in the limited time I have remaining, to constitutionalize this a bit, because these are very important issues. And I submit to the panel that this court is going to be faced with many post-Skilling difficult decisions, where there's going to be an effort to transmogrify honest services fraud that's now prohibited into money or property fraud. And the court needs to proceed with real precision and understand, as the Supreme Court told us in Skilling, that just as the pre-McNally decisional law was quite instructive about what the core of honest services fraud is, this court should look carefully at what the government was doing pre-Skilling and determine how that translates into post-Skilling analysis. And here, the government had an honest services fraud theory. It unequivocally abandoned it, and when it did, it abandoned the heart of this indictment. I reserve the rest of my time. I'm sorry, I have a little more time remaining. I apologize. The indictment itself requires a careful parsing because, and I'll start with count one, after charging basically in the statutory language, it proceeds through critical paragraphs 16, 17, 18, and 19. And in fact, in closing argument, the government stood up and told the jury, all you need to look at is paragraph 18. That's our whole theory. That came about as a result of the fact that the government submitted a redacted indictment that took out everything I'm saying they abandoned. The trial judge looked at that and said, well, you know, you just can't do that. These indictments mean something. You can't go as far from the grand jury as you're attempting to do here. So what I'll permit you to do, rather than accept all of your redactions, I'll accept some of them, stand up in front of the jury, tell them what you're abandoning, and they did. And what they abandoned was honest services. What they abandoned was the bribes for lies theory. Bribes and kickbacks aren't in this case, they said repeatedly. What they were left with was nothing that had been charged by the grand jury. Reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Berry.
Richard Berry for the United States. May it please the court, counsel. If I may, let me begin by trying by addressing Judge Higginbotham's question. The pitch at trial was twofold. First and foremost, that you cannot have that since we chose the phrase bribery and kickback, there must be a quid pro quo. True if you're charged under the bribery statute, not true in this circuit or any other circuit if you're charged under the wire fraud and mail fraud statutes. Beginning an opening argument and continuing through the entire 28 days of the trial, lead defense counsel repeatedly stressed, first to the district court and later to the jury, the indictment contains the phrases bribes and kickbacks. Ergo, there must be a quid pro quo. There must be something in exchange for that, completely ignoring the concealment language that's in each of the substantive counts of the indictment. The pitch at closing argument was the same as the pitch at the trial and the pitch in the opening argument. If the indictment contains the phrase bribe and kickback, there must be a quid pro quo. Rossow and Prestridge were far too far down in the Hartford hierarchy to accord any quid pro quo. The settlement had to be reviewed by their superiors, by the legal department, by other insurance companies, by reinsurance companies, by essentially everyone involved in.
The money paid didn't exact the settlement. The settlement was independently good.
That was their defense.
That's their defense. Okay. But what troubles me is, in the real world of trials, that abandoning theories midstream like that gives the government a chance to carve and cut and shape in a way that the grand jury had not originally given them. You went to trial on that indictment, and then I understand why you want to dance away from honest services. You were right in doing that, of course. But that, with the defendant has now committed themselves to a theory of defense. We're talking about the theories of the government. The defensive theory was out there too, but it was only after the defensive theory was exposed that, as I understand, you abandoned this. And that strikes me as a jeopardy, a form of jeopardy. I'm just talking to you about the real world of trials, which I do know something about. What troubles me about the government's position in this case, and I agree with counsel opposite that we're going to see a lot of this with honest services has been redefined by the High Court.
I understand your comments, Judge Higginbotham. I respectfully disagree in this instance. And instead of talking in broad brush about the indictment, let's just look at the first fraud count, count three. Omitting the formal parts, the defendants did knowingly devise and intend to devise a scheme, first, to defraud the Hartford of the right to honest services of its employees, Rossow and Prestige, comma, and the only thing missing there is parenthesis two, close parenthesis, and to obtain money and property from the Hartford and its subsidiaries through false and fraudulent pretenses, including the concealment of material facts appears in all of the wire fraud counts and all of the mail fraud counts, all of which specifically include both 1341 or 1343, depending, and 1346. Yes. We started with two theories. We tried the entire case with two theories. We went to the jury with only one theory for essentially two strategic reasons, which aren't technically in the transcript of the jury charge conference, but as you correctly intuited, in the first instance, we were well aware that Wyrick and Black had already been granted cert and that Skilling would in all probability be granted cert. foreseeing to some extent the potential problem with honest services and being somewhat comfortable with the theory that the payments to Rossow and Prestige were undisclosed, the trial team elected to jettison.
And perhaps uncomfortable with the defensive approach that this was a good settlement independent of this and there was no quid pro quo. These guys were low-level officials that didn't pull it off.
I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the evidence is far from clear that it was a good settlement based on historical settlement values. The fact remains that entire analysis begs the question because the two representatives from Hartford were crystal clear in their testimony at trial. Had we known that our employees were corrupted, we would not have engaged in the settlement.
Well, yeah, that's quite a different thing than the independent value of the settlement itself. Had they known they were corrupt, they would have fired them. A lot of things would happen. But had they, regardless of the question was, what do you do if the circumstance that this was a good settlement in any event? And what happens is that there was a rake-off by the low-level employees. That does set up a jury argument to me that there was no bribe. They weren't bribed in a way that caused the Hartford to do something it wouldn't otherwise have done on the merits.
Well, in the abstract scheme of things, and in fact, in this particular case, I would respectfully submit that by definition, it could not be a good settlement and there still be a $3.2 million rake-off. The rake-off came in large measure from Tom Bilek's percentage of what should have been the legal fees paid to the law firm of Hafner and Bilek. There was also substantial testimony that the money eventually came out of the settlement that would have been paid to the individual plaintiffs. Be that as it may, there were still $3.2 million in undisclosed payments. Yes, John, I'm sorry.
Isn't Mr. Beformant correct that the way it is alleged, and I mean, you kind of pointed to it, where you do not separate it out as a second separate set of facts, but is almost part and parcel of honest services, that once you abandon honest services, you also abandon the allegations of concealment. And it's the way it's alleged. In other words, it wasn't alleged and as a separate, separate paragraph or whatever. I mean, I guess the question is there case law to support that you can, in fact, separate this second phraseology of the, or theory of the underlying facts?
At the outset, I would argue that it might arguably have been better drafted, but it is literally all but two separate sentences in each of the fraud counts. There's the honest services allegation, and there's the deprivation of money through false and fraudulent pretenses allegation.
But you're suggesting this, the two theories were incorporated in the language. In effect, there were two theories and not a second concealment factual scenario that comes under honest services.
Yes, sir, Your Honor, that is correct.
But do you see how it could be that way?
And
that's why to me this is a little bit dicier than perhaps.
I understand your question, and I would respectfully respond by referring to United States versus Lowe, 248 Fed 3rd 449, and obviously I'll submit a 28-J letter. And United States versus Lucas, 516 316. False representations include concealment of a material fact along with intent to defraud. And as I said, in this case, it's the honest services in the first part of the sentence and the concealment of material facts in the second part of the sentence.
He clearly alleged a second theory separate and apart from honest services.
Yes, sir, Judge Garza. I respectfully submit we very clearly allege two independent theories.
And I am correct, or am I not correct, that the elements of proving honest services and the elements of proving fraud by concealment are separate.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And
you
they're
are
not correct. They're not subspecies of the same theory.
No, sir, Your Honor. They're certainly not after Skilling. But no, no, I don't actually. I don't believe they
right before Skilling.
No, I don't believe they were. I don't believe they were before Skilling either. Actually. Which goes back to your original comments. We began with
double jeopardy. You can't have double jeopardy unless you have substantially the same elements of the that were abandoned.
Precisely, Your Honor. And in this case, the only theory that we abandoned was honest services. We indicted concealment and honest services. We abandoned honest services. We went to the jury with concealment and did not get a verdict.
Now, let's talk about the flip side, the effect on the defendant. Was the why wasn't the abandonment of honest services hurtful, harmful to the defendant's theory in this case?
One of the defendant's theories in this case was that since the indictment used the phrase bribery and kickbacks, there must be a quid pro quo. Again, true perhaps under the bribery statute, certainly not true under the wire fraud and mail fraud statutes. The second theory is that the settlement amounts were legitimate, which I certainly do not concede and would not concede. The testimony on that was anything but straightforward. And I would respectfully submit that if there was enough money to take $3 million out of the deal, $3.2 million out of the settlement, how could it have been a legitimate settlement? The third theory, of course, sensing that perhaps the quid pro quo argument might not work, was that Rossow used her influence with David Kane to extort the money from Mr. Havener. As to your question, how was it hurtful to the defendant, I would respectfully submit that it was not. As the district court, as Judge Hittner noted on several occasions, usually referring to lead defense counsel, you have known all along what the government's theory is. You may not like their theory, but you understood their theory from the beginning. And I set out in the brief several examples of exchanges between defense counsel urging the if bribery and kickback language, there must be a quid pro quo argument, first to the district court, who clearly was not adopting that argument, and then to the jury, which may or may not have adopted it given the outcome of the trial. Nonetheless, as Judge Hittner noted on at least two occasions and probably several more, defense counsel was always well aware that it was indicted as honest services and concealment, and that one of the two theories was there was no disclosure to the Hartford or to any of the other parties of the payments to Rossow and Prestige. The phrases bribery and kickback obviously are terms of art in the federal criminal arena, but they do accurately and correctly describe the undisclosed, under-the-table, unreported payments.
Is there evidence in the record that Hartford would not have settled this case for this amount of money had they known that a substantial amount of this money, was diverted?
Both of their representatives testified that they would not have settled these claims had they known that Rossow and Prestige were receiving undisclosed, unreported payments. I do not know if they were asked the question precisely as you just phrased it, but they were both asked point blank, would you, meaning, of course, would the Hartford have settled these claims had you known that Rossow and Prestige were receiving payments from Havener? And both representatives said no. And I could find that in a second. It is both of the.
No, as long as it's in the record and it's in the briefs, I don't.
It's cited in my brief, and I apologize. I just.
We'll find
it. This instant. But I promise you that it is there along with the record site, of course. as I say, we started with two theories. We tried the case with two theories. We abandoned the honest services theory for tactical reasons, several tactical reasons. Immediately prior to submitting the case to the jury, we proceeded to the jury on concealment, and the jury was unable to reach a verdict. Precisely as Judge Garza said, there's absolutely nothing in double jeopardy or in any other legal theory that precludes retrying Mr. Haefner on the concealment theory, which has simply been amplified in the second superseding indictment. The concealment language was in count one, the funneled funds through Haefner to Rossow and Prestow language. Prestow. The language was in count one of the original indictment. It was in the superseding indictment. It is in count one of the second superseding indictment. The concealment language was in the wire fraud and mail fraud counts of the original indictment. It is clarified somewhat in the superseding indictment. It is clarified in the second superseding indictment. But there is absolutely nothing that precludes retrial on the concealment theory as to Mr. Haefner. The court has no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. If I could briefly address some of the points that were raised in the government's argument. First, I think that we need to clarify, and there needs to be no confusion about what was abandoned here. Honest services was abandoned, and in counts 3 through 9, honest services was linked to concealment. Honest services was not charged in count one. The second abandonment was of the theory that the payments had been made in exchange for the misrepresentation that the settlements were in the best interest of the Hartford. Now, that theory, as charged to the grand jury, included the possibility of concealment. But the question is, concealment of what? It was the concealment of the kickback or the bribe. It was not the concealment of the mere fact that the payment was made. That was not charged by the grand jury. And that is evident from an analysis of the grand jury's language, what it chose to put into the indictment. Now, while this court has often held that it is sufficient under the Sixth Amendment to charge in statutory language, where the grand jury chooses to give additional details, then the court and the government are bound by what the grand jury found. Here, the manner and means allegations that were incorporated virtually identical into each count of the indictment make it quite clear what the misrepresentations and concealments were. They begin in paragraph 16, which is the equivalent of paragraph 6 in each of the substantive counts. Defendants met and communicated while they were negotiating settlements. They had an opportunity to do some hanky-panky. Paragraph 17, Haefner made payments to Rossow and Prestige through bribes and kickbacks for recommending that the Hartford would pay certain amounts to settle the claims of his clients. They took advantage of the opportunity. They made the payments. It was a quid pro quo for making the recommendations. The critical paragraph 18, that again the prosecutor stood up in closing and told the jury, we're scaling back, their exact language. All you need to look at is paragraph 18. Defendants did falsely promise, pretend, and represent to the Hartford that the settlement amounts were appropriate and in its best interest, well knowing that the defendants intended that some of the money would be funneled to Haefner, by Haefner, to Rossow and Prestige. The well knowing wasn't a separate concealment phase. It was merely the way that the grand jury said these are false statements. They told Rossow and Prestige, told the Hartford, these statements are in your best interest, well knowing that they were getting money. If the court were to permit, in the face of that specific language of the indictment, for the government to proceed on what it now claims are its two theories, one theory, honest services fraud that is somehow magically being transformed into the money or property fraud, this entire scheme that was just laid out in those paragraphs, and a second theory, that whether there was a bribe or kickback, whether it was for or because of a recommendation, the mere fact that the payments were made, nowhere in those paragraphs does that appear as a separate theory. It was not charged by the grand jury. In Green, in Ash, and most recently in Yeager, the Supreme Court has reiterated that the successive prosecution bar of the Double Jeopardy Clause is there for an important reason. It is to prohibit successive prosecution because of the anguish, the expense, the wear and tear on the defendant, and the possibility that the government, through dry runs and trying over and over again, will be able to convict. They had their chance. They tried their theory. They couldn't get a conviction. Double jeopardy applied, and they should not be given a second chance. Thank you.